time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday the 17th September 2011. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 to 12 by The Village Butchery. You'll find them at 102 Oceanview Road, Oneroa. On Saturday the 17th of September, Sharon Brown talked about Basil Holmes with Alan Knight, Brent Simpson and Greg Treadwell.
So I've got Alan Knight here, and one of the things that we wanted to do on Waiheke Radio is that, you know, Basil Holmes passed away last Friday. And as you kind of go through the community, when you tell people, you don't realise how many people he knew and what an effect he had on the community. And he felt very strongly that he didn't want to be celebrated, and he was very much against the cult of the individual. Having said that, he also had such a special place in everyone's heart, which is kind of why what we're doing this morning is maybe just spending a little bit of time reading some quotes and just having a little bit of a Barney that hopefully he would have enjoyed and not been highly offended by. Hi, Alan.
Yes, let's hope so.
Great. So so how did you know Basil?
Well, the very first time I came across Basil Holmes was at the... there was a candidates meeting at the Morrow Hall. This was during the 99 general election. And it was a bit of a dry old do. It wasn't the most interesting election we've ever had in this country. And it was held on a weekday afternoon, so it was fairly sparsely attended. But a number of the candidates from the Auckland region had made the effort to come over to Waiheke to just front up and talk about the election. And I took the afternoon off work. I was determined I was going to sort of go to every single meeting. I like to get involved in these things.
At that time, was it unusual for the candidates to have made it out?
Oh, no, I don't think so. They would generally do that. I think it was... I forget who organised it. But anyway, it was a fairly tiresome afternoon. There wasn't a whole lot of exciting stuff going on.
Sounds like a lot of meetings.
I hadn't been on the island all that long, and I was sort of sitting there, and I was almost at the point of thinking, well, I might give up on this and go back to work, when this small, very tough-looking man of indeterminate age got up and began to talk. And I'd never heard anything quite like it, certainly not in real life. And he basically brought the meeting to a halt, because by the time he'd finished, everyone was looking at each other as, anyone want to try and follow that? I don't think you could. It was the kind of public speaking that has almost disappeared. I mean, some people have a natural gift for it, and this man clearly did. So as the meeting broke up, I went over and introduced myself. And I said, where on earth did you learn to speak in public like that? And he sort of fixed me with his hard stare and went, the dock strikes in the 1950s. I said, well, that explains a lot. And from that point on, I was always very keen to run into Basil, and he used to come up a lot when I was working up here at Artworks. He'd stop by and come in for a chat, and he, quite apart from his passion for politics, which of course was really his defining feature, he also had this enormous interest in vintage comedy. When he found out I was similarly interested, he used to come in and he'd find things on the internet relating to artists like Peter Cook and so forth. He was a great fan of Peter Cook, as was I. And he'd come in and talk about that. But it was always a great pleasure when anything political was going on, whether it was a general election or that little set to we had last year on the island over the community board. There was something always very reassuring whenever you went into any political gathering on the island, that there would be Basil.
Mm. I think the thing about the reassuring is that he was a person of incredible... what his politics probably matched up a lot with mine, and he was a person of incredible integrity. Mm. What I always felt is that he lived his life according to the beliefs that he had.
Yes.
So, for example, in the way that, you know, even if we have quite socialist views, we still... most of us still try and create a nest egg or buy a house or make sure that we're secure in our lives, and then we try and think about the rest of the world, and he very much lived his whole life in
he talked really the talk and he walked the walk, no doubt about it,
with the sense of community. And I think that's where he got the mana from, you know.
Yes,
that you knew that he really believed what he said.
Personally, of course, his politics and mine couldn't have been more opposed.
Mm.
We're very, very different in political outlook. But as you say, his involvement and his passion for what he believed in, he was something rather unique. And I think with his passing this week, our community has lost, not as the local paper said. I mean, they described him as a local character.
Yeah,
I always think that's rather a throwaway word that sort of describes somebody who hangs around the Ostend market muttering to themselves and wearing a funny hat. Basil Holmes was, I think, a little more than just a local character. He was an vital part of
the other thing I loved about him is, you know, he lived through periods of time that I could only read about in books, and he was at very significant moments of New Zealand history. I mean, like he was, you know, he was at the Springbok tour, he was at the miners' strike, he was there. I don't know if he was at the dock workers' strike in 51, but he was certainly in that space.
Yes.
And he was also alive. He also had a sense of the beginnings of the Labour Party. And I remember I saw him at a... it was something at the Heritage Festival, actually. They showed a film that he'd been quite... I think it was Fighting Back, that his about his brother, who was a filmmaker who'd been blacklisted in the 50s. and he was very aware of how the dock workers' strike, where someone, or the strike in Waihi, the miners' strike, where someone had actually got killed, that happened under a Labour government. So although he was very pro-Labour, he was also incredibly suspicious of the politics of Labour.
That's something I always find is admirable, is those who not only cling to a particular set of ideological beliefs, but are aware of the fact that they're not always perfect and they can be critical of those things. And yes, as you say, he lived through an amazing amount of social turmoil and came to the end of his life with a huge sense of, you got a sense of history talking to him.
Now, talking about that turmoil in later life, I've got a little... I'm just looking for it, actually. Where's it gone? I had it all called out. Okay, I might have to go and look for it again. But someone sent in a little Dylan Thomas poem that they would like to have read out, so I'm just going to look for that for a second.
Right,
Yes, the other thing that I really liked about him is that he just had such a great turn of phrase, which is, I think, what you were talking about before.
He really did. To hear him go off at a public meeting, that he had this incredible way of delivering a speech off the top of his head and absolutely pitch perfect. He would sort of start off as mildly concerned, then he'd go through to reasonably incensed, and then take it up and up and up in pitch to this incredible, passionate, long drawn out stream of beautifully placed words.
That's right, usually finger pointing.
Yes.
And then at some point someone would say, Basil, can you put this motion forward?
Yes.
And then that's how I know.
I think also one of the things, and I suppose it's a shame, we really should have filmed more of what he was capable of doing, to show to a younger generation, to say this is what it was like when people really spoke on the fly, when politics and public discussion wasn't about sound bites and the sanitized let's try and please as many people as possible approach. Basil's approach was immensely confrontational and fascinating to listen to.
And that's interesting, the confrontation, isn't it? Because we tend not to debate in that way. And what was great about that is there was always something you could pin onto. It would be like, I really disagree with that, or I really agree with that. But you had a position from which you could debate, because he really put his positions forward. He wasn't sort of thinking, oh, you know, is this politically correct?
Yes.
Or, you know, I hope no one's going to come back at me for saying this, or, you know.
He told it as he saw it.
And I interviewed him a couple of years ago, and I was just listening to that last night, and he just had some great lines. I just thought, you know, he was talking about Afghanistan. He goes, "You don't go into Afghanistan to pat them on the head. You go in there to kill Afghanis." You know, he's just this sort of, you know, just saying it straight up. Now, I've got a little quote here from, it's the first verse of a Dylan Thomas poem that always reminded this person of Basil. Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rage at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. And I think it's quite interesting because that's quite powerful, but it was a really quiet rage, really understated.
Yes.
And I really like the fact that he didn't believe in that kind of, like we were saying, that kind of cult of the personality and being out there, and he was always kind of understated.
Yep.
Yeah.
But I think that rage against the dying of the light, I think that says it pretty well.
Yeah.
And yeah. Thanks, Basil, for everything.
Yes,
I enjoyed the talks and the political meetings and all the wonderful excitement of having him as part of our community, and we shall miss him greatly.
Yes, indeed. Thanks so much for coming in. Great. And Alan, what are you? Is there other stuff that you would like to talk about?
Oh goodness, no. Let's save it for Opinionated Islanders. I've got any number of things I wanted to talk about, but. Right now, I've got to pop back over to the brewery and check my beer's all right.
Okay, lovely, great. Well, here I am with Brent and... Brent, what's your last name?
Country Mike.
Country Mike. Brent, Country Mike. And Country Mike, Brent. And Greg.
Do we get surnames this week?
Well, you've been promoted, yes. And well, Greg Treadwell.
Thanks. Not that I really care.
It's of course you don't.
I couldn't bear the idea of sitting and listening to a radio show to somebody called Dave and just not being able to pick up the phone later and abuse them. That's not an invitation, actually.
No. Okay, good. So, guys, you both had dealings with Basil Holmes, and you had things that you maybe wanted to say?
Well, you know, I didn't hear... My dealing with him, I suppose, is a little bit out of the ordinary. I didn't particularly know him very well. I had met him a couple of times and spoken to him, and I'd seen him talk at various sort of community groups and things. But a couple of years ago, I was writing a master's thesis on radio on Waiheke, and one of the things I was looking at was how the sort of particular characteristics of this island shaped the way that the radio station responded, and what the sort of relationship was between the radio and the kind of the characteristics of the island. And I came across around the same time, 2008 this was around the time that that people were making submissions to the Royal Commission on Auckland Governance. And I thought, well, this is a good place to go for a quote, you know, I'll find someone in there that just seemed a good way where people were expressing how they felt about the relationship between the island and the city and things that were going on at the time. And I found this, Basil Holmes' submission to the Commission on Rural Governance, and it was just such a beautifully written submission. It was 2 pages long, and out of all the ones that I sort of you know skimmed through at the time, it had a kind of a unique. I thought it had quite a unique slant on the whole thing, and it was so articulate. It was kind of like whenever I had seen Basil speak, I was always impressed by, you know, this slightly diminutive figure, but with this, you know, really articulate. And quite forthcoming opinions, and his piece was just like that, and it worked out perfectly for my thesis. So I quoted it, and I thought I'd just come in today and read a little bit about it. And what I kind of found interesting about it was this kind of vision that he had, which is, you know, absolutely just spot on for today. It's almost like uncanny, because he talked about the gentrification of the island, and there's been a story in the Herald about people being priced out of the island today.
There's a story in the Herald today?
Yeah, it was either today or yesterday about people being priced off the island. And also, he also spoke in this about elderly people, and so with the closing of the... Seaside Sanctuary. It's almost...
It all just seems to tie together at the moment. Eh? Yeah.
So I thought I'd just read a paragraph of it to give you a little people who maybe didn't get the chance to hear him speak or you know, the man. So, and he had, you know, what I think was interesting is about how he kind of, his sort of macro view of it was how there were all these competing visions for Waiheke, and he was going to add his into the mix. And so here's what he said in his submission to Auckland Governance. And so this is straight from that. He goes, "There is a mischievous version of Waiheke perpetrated by the shallow ends of the media, tacitly encouraged by certain city officials, more openly by would-be developers and their noisier but minority of friends on the island. The myth is that the island is to be a haven for the wealthy, and therefore the future shape and economics of the island has to be geared for this, including the assumption that wealthy islanders can pay with ease for expensive capital works. Actually, the population of Waiheke remains a cross-section of the New Zealand demographics, and the prospect, for example, of retired residents being driven off by economic challenges arouses quite a depth of negative feelings. The people who have created the modern Waiheke Island, and this includes veterans of World War II, should not be so treated, nor should anywhere in the Hauraki Gulf become virtually out of bounds for ordinary New Zealanders for economic or other reasons. This, least of all, by the Commission making recommendations that can even accidentally cause this form of economic apartheid, or as some call it, economic cleansing." And which I thought was a beautiful sort of a summation. And if you're interested, you can still go to the you can sort of still Google submissions to the Royal Commission, and you can download just a couple of pages of Basil's submission. And it's just very. It just rings, doesn't it? I mean, it's...
That's fantastic. It is, yeah, it? That's fantastic, Brent. Thanks for that. I've read too many submissions to the local government process over the years, so many that, in fact, you know, you sort of... They become a bland mix of of political perspectives without an individuality. I mean, occasionally you get one. John Hawkesby's comment in a submission to the council is still on the back end of many cars when he said... Waiheke far enough to be behind to be ahead, and that was picked up by us at Gulf News when I worked at Gulf News, and then that was picked up by the people who make Tony Wells, who owned the video shop, you know, and he printed it. But so there's the occasional things, but Basil every time wrote in a way that showed a depth of understanding of society, that he wasn't, his submissions weren't about, you know, whether the boundaries should be a meter closer to the road or not. His submissions were always about how ordinary people were affected by local government processes, and he was deeply involved in that. He was deeply passionate. And you know, I was sad to see this week that there wasn't, in my view, enough tribute to Basil in the media.
I think people slightly got wrong-footed because he'd been so insistent that there shouldn't be anything on him. Although I have to say that Basil did always, you know, enjoy attention or people talking to him, and I'm sure he would have enjoyed being
celebrated. Oh, absolutely. He'd be crowded by gorgeous women all around him at any... peculiar function, and that was he was the most sexy man on the island, frankly, and he was a nude model. That might have something to do with it.
Oh, really?
Perhaps other people saw him in ways we didn't.
How there were so many women around him, and unfortunately, none of the women who were around him wanted to come in because they're quite shy, perhaps. But the other thing I think he also sort of he's talked about the super city, and one of the things that he preempted there was this notion of it. He said, you know, it's going to be a huge bureaucracy, and at some point it's going to become unstable. And I think you can already see that, or those of us who were against the super city from the beginning kind of can see that already.
Yep.
And people who've worked under the local county council, Auckland City Council, and now the Super City, are saying it's really difficult to work under these circumstances. It takes so long to get anything done, and it's really hard to pin down who's responsible for anything.
Yeah.
That was exactly the sort of thing Basil railed against, the sort of, I mean he was a communist, let's not mince our words, and he was a fantastic communist. He was an intellectual, he was a man of the working people, he was a deep he had a great understanding of art and spirituality, and he wasn't a simplistic political figure. He was a deeply compassionate individual, and he brought all those qualities to the island, and those are the things I'm going to miss. I'm going to miss seeing him pacing up and down the causeway, which was where I seem to see him most in recent times, mostly pacing up and down with his hands behind his back, deep in thought, waiting for a bus. But and I'll miss that. But what I'll miss is that another great angle to Waiheke's gone. That's we're a much poorer place without Basil Holmes.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And I think the other thing was around the. Oh, I forgot what I was going to say. Carry on.
Well, I'll just keep going on because I got to finish this thought while I'm on it. He was often sidelined by people who didn't like the fact he was a communist, and he was sidelined by people, and I think he's been sidelined by the media after his death. He's been described as quick to comment. Now, this is that's a kind of
nail of death.
Yeah, how dare you be quick to comment? No, but I mean that wasn't necessarily a negative statement, but to just sort of put it all down into quick to comment, he wasn't quick to comment. His thoughts were slow, progressive, well formed, and well articulated. There was a headline saying an island character dies. I mean, let's say the island's greatest communist has died, and you know.
Yeah, say this? This is what I was going to say. This thing of communist. I mean, yes, he was in the sense that he believed that, you know, he really believed in equality, but he also had a deep suspicion of politicians generally wherever they came from. And one of the things was that he did live through a miners' strike where it was the Labour government who caused the death of somebody in the strike by going up against them, you know. He was also deeply against Roger Douglas, who also came to prominence under a Labour government.
But that Labour government was the beginning of the neoliberals in New Zealand.
Absolutely.
I mean, they
were. So he was communist, but he wasn't he was a communist because of the values,
absolutely.
Not from a party political point of view.
Absolutely.
And he had a deep distrust of party politics.
I guess a better way to put it is then that he was a Marxist.
Yeah, possibly.
Than a communist. He wasn't party political, absolutely. Let's make that clear.
I mean, his expression is the further reaches of his expression are deeply suspicious of the centralization of government that he saw happening under the super city, and this was his biggest fear, was that centralization was just going to further erode any sort of input that that local communities would have. And so I think he has a title on this piece, and it's called Democracy, and I think he's probably right.
I think he was right. I also think that the super city which he was so suspicious. I think one of the reasons he was suspicious of it was he valued individuality, and he valued character, and he valued, when you think of, you know, the common view of communism is that it wipes out individuality. And I think this is a misreading of Marx entirely. Mm-hmm. And I think Basil was one of those lefties who represented a purist Marxist approach, and that he wanted to empower ordinary people to be individuals, not to be some Soviet treadmill kind of worker. I mean, I don't think that's the communism Basil stood for at all. And I think his own individuality and quirkiness and what I'll remember about him too is that the level of respect he brought to any conversation with anyone. He respected people, and that's these days pretty hard to find at that
and
level.
And again, I think that goes back to his, the incredible integrity he brought to things, that he, really, to quote an overphrased phrase, it's he really, walked the walk. He, he lived by
up and down the causeway.
But he also, he was very consistent. He wasn't a swing voter. He wasn't like, I'll vote this way because, maybe I'll get, a little bit of a tax break, or I'll vote that way because I've got kids and they're growing up and maybe I'll do better. He had certain values, and he really, he always spoke, consistently with those values.
I guess the reason I feel confident that we can call him a Marxist is that he really believed in the political and understanding of the political economy of Waiheke, and that so he didn't just look at the island as a place where it was lovely to live. He looked at the structure of the community we have, and who had the resources and who didn't have the resources. And I guess that's the fundamental political economy approach, isn't it?
So segue into political economy, where you two have been, at a conference.
The Marx brothers. they should call us the Marx Brothers, really.
He dragged me along.
Oh, right, okay.
he was itching to go. I got him a cheap price.
So can you just explain what political economy is, or what it means, or what it represents?
You first.
We know even less now.
Yeah, well, look, it was an amazing two-day conference at AUT. It was called the Political Economy of Communication Conference, organized by a couple of associate professors, one within the school where I work, Associate Professor Wayne Hope, and then my former boss, Associate Professor Martin Hurst, who's now gone back to Australia to live and work, but came back to help organise this conference.
That name sounds really familiar.
Yeah, well, he was the head of...
Well known,
yeah, he was a sort of... He was here for 4.5 years from Australia. He was vocal, provocative, and occasionally abrasive, and so therefore caught quite a lot of attention. Of course, because he was an outspoken Marxist himself, he sort of bore the wrath of the communities, some of the community, but anyway, not the island community, but the academic community I'm referring to there. But let's not talk about Martin because he's gone, and he was my boss for 4.5 years.
So. Let's talk about the conference. Yeah, the conference was half of the people were delivering papers that were had a quite Marxist bent, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. I had a German postgraduate student who's a young German postgraduate student who said to me afterwards, for a moment, I didn't know where I was. I thought the wall was back up.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because there's Marx, as many people have noted in the conference itself, and just generally, the guy's back. He's big time again. There's been a book just released recently by Terry Eagleton called Why Marx Was Right, and a lot of people are sort of revisiting not so much a Marxism as a sort of a utopian vision for the future, but as a tool for analyzing, sort of a lot of the situation that we would see with crumbling of capital and things like that going on around us. So he's kind of had a bit of a resurgence amongst academia and even popularly, I suppose. I mean, Eagleton's book is, although it's probably quite academic, it's sort of a more in the popular vein in a way. He doesn't sort of, it's not really delving into the nitty gritties of it, but it is sort of trying to tackle some of the more popular objections that people that you might hear about Marxism and sort of tackle them in these chapters. So that's an interesting book to check out, Terry Eagleton's Why Marx Was Right. So that was a lot of people brought up this resurgence of Marx, and then because it had a focus on the media and
so what specific aspects of Marx are seeing the resurgence?
Well, I think as Brent says, it's right, it's not about the utopian vision of the potential of humanity to force its way through the nasty capitalist era into what was going to be the determined future anyway. As Associate Professor Wayne Hope put it to me in a quiet moment this week, Karl might have been wrong about socialism, but he was sure as hell right about capitalism.
Yeah.
And I think that we're now seeing, everywhere you look, you can see the concentrations of capital just further isolating ordinary people from power. And wherever you come from politically yourself, it's pretty hard to argue that capitalism is distributing wealth evenly. But the political economy approach, I suppose, is that very thing, that if you want to understand society, the first place you've got to look is how it distributes its resources and who owns the means of production and all those sort of old lefty terms, all those Marxist terms. And as Brent says, he's coming back in, not because people are necessarily joining together in some hope of a Marxist revolution, not at all, but just as an analytical tool for understanding where we're at.
And what's happening. I mean, these are some, large macro-level changes that are taking place, and a lot of them were sort of predicted or, can be easily seen in Marx's work, which we're talking about 150 years ago.
That's right. I mean, control of the means of production. I mean, how old is that term?
That's one of the ones that I think is an earlier, shift that we see happening. I mean, particularly with the internet, the means of production have shifted towards, individuals. And I think analyzing the kind of labor that individuals do now is of crucial for understanding a lot of the changes, is that we work differently than we did 10-15 years ago, and we now sort of own in a way some of the means of production that prior to the internet weren't available to us. We essentially own printing presses, we own big copying machines that can reproduce objects that we now exchange, digital objects.
Well, we can exchange objects without any need for printing at all.
Yeah, I mean, the way capital is generated is changing. I mean, it's quite. I mean, a lot of people talked about sort of immaterial labor practices, and when I think about what I do on a day to day basis, that's what I do. I don't make pens or I don't make pencils or anything like that. I make digital objects. Now, that just seems a very abstract sort of thing to be making, but that's what I do. I make relationships between people. I work immaterially, and that changes the formula. And you can see, you know, how large corporations, the Facebooks and et cetera, these kind of large, basically capital organizations are now sort of co-opting my work, my free time. Maybe they're co-opting my leisure time because I'm on Facebook and stuff. So a lot of people talked about, you know, the changing nature of labor as something to look at and investigate. But, I mean, one of the things that I thought about was the kind of how political economy sort of takes these macro level views. You know, it tries to sort of stand back and say, okay, who is benefiting? What kind of organizations, individuals, political agents are benefiting from changes in society, and how are they influencing politics? And that kind of, for me, is one of the things that political economy tries to do, is to say, you know, what are the motivations of these people? And these people are powerful. Someone talked about the Berlusconi. Yeah, you should tell your Berlusconi story. Then you have an anecdote that someone.
They're one of the keynote speakers at the conference was an amazing professor Graham Murdoch, who is English in origin, but is actually moving out to live in Auckland and take up a part-time position at the University of Auckland. And he had a lovely quote from Silvio Berlusconi. He was talking about evil media magnates and how he'd been. Berlusconi obviously is the prime minister, is he, or is he the president? He's the prime minister.
Prime minister
of Italy, and he. You know, he's scandalous and he surrounds himself by cronies and he, you know, there's a huge level of...
He's the largest media owner in the country, isn't he?
Oh, well, he's the Prime Minister and the largest media owner
like
in the country. It would be like Murdoch being the Prime Minister
of Australia.
Or Australia, yeah. Prime Minister of New Zealand. No, but he... Berlusconi is also, you know... accused of, obviously I don't have the proof of this, but accused of accepting money from the mafia or surrounding himself by cronies. And when he's had a floozy for a while, she tends to end up in Parliament somehow. You know, this has happened.
Absolutely. There aren't many opportunities for us.
That's exactly right. And I tell you, the Italian Parliament is probably the sexiest Parliament in the world because of it. But
and I bet they get heaps done too.
Probably, but anyway, he's a deeply suspicious individual.
We won't talk about the demise of feminism.
I'm
sure if some of the Greens got their kit off, they'd probably get in a bit more easily.
I don't know.
Well, maybe not actually. Yeah.
One of them's a very good friend of mine. I can't comment on that. So anyway, Graham Murdoch had this quote up on his slides at this conference about Berlusconi. It was essentially. Taped during a private telephone conversation with somebody slagging off Italy and saying that he couldn't wait to get out of this bloody horrible mucking country, you know. And when you're the Prime Minister, I think that's just not a good look. But anyway, Murdoch was asking, you know, why shouldn't he call him an evil media mogul? Because he is evil and he does own the media and he is a mogul. So
chucked in with a bunch of, funny cartoons about our friend... Murdoch, not the Murdoch at the thing, but the other Murdoch. What's his first name?
Rupert
Murdoch, whose cards have been revealed of late, those issues around Murdoch's get further and further. I mean, you know, the guy, he was paying police officers. And he was actually paying, you know, he's funding politicians left, right, and centre to promote his agenda. He's
probably Rupert's 70s, well into his 80s.
You see, it's quite interesting because, in fact, he'd be the same generation as Basil. And I was just thinking of the name, you know, Rupert and Basil, they're very sort of dated names.
From diametrically opposed positions on the political spectrum. And Rupert Murdoch, I mean, Graham Murdoch, the Professor Graham Murdoch, and he spelt with a CK at the end of his name, so not CH like Rupert, but Professor Graham Murdoch was saying, just in a sort of casual moment during the conference or in question and answers, that he, you know, as Brent says, you know, Rupert Murdoch is paying police and influencing power and controlling media and the quote Graham Murdoch, the phrase Graham Murdoch used was that he had shut down the imaginative universe as a result. So we can't imagine us. And so when somebody like Rupert Murdoch is controlling our lives to that point, and let's not underestimate the relationship between the state of our lives and the state of communication and within that state of the media and the consolidation of media and the influence
Murdoch's empire
and the influence on the national conversation. What are we allowed to talk about? What is right and what is considered wrong? When Rupert Murdoch is controlling that conversation to that degree, I'm quite with Professor Graham Murdoch when he says that these evil media magnates are shutting down the imaginative universe on us.
I have something here from Basil again, just because I've been reading about him a little bit, but he was talking about how you know, there was a time when if there was great violence in different parts of the world, there'd be like a wave of revulsion and shock around people's reactions to it, and now it's almost become that, oh well, that's just one other thing that happens, and people don't really, you know, it's almost like, yeah, well, there's that whole argument around being desensitized or feeling that things have happened to other people or.
Yeah, I mean, I think New Zealand's, I mean, other examples, I mean, I think the London riots are possibly an example of where, you know, people, I don't believe for a minute, and I don't think a lot of people do, that these are just, you know, bored youth going out on a Friday night to stir stuff up. I mean, some other motivation
everything
in there.
Everything is
connected. And they're not seeing themselves reflected in the state of politics or possibly even the sort of, you know, the media images that are being projected. They're just, they, you know, they're disenfranchised and they're reacting against it. And I think there's many movements around the world at the moment that are starting to emerge. There's a far more peaceful movement going on in Spain, you know, that particularly deserves a lot more attention than it got, and it deserves a hell of a lot more attention possibly than the London ones.
Well, in Spain, unemployment runs at 25%. Right, I mean, and it has done ever since I lived there
the
in
US
91.
Just a couple
so
of days ago.
So you can
ago.
Imagine there's a whole population of educated, university-educated people, who, one of whom I met was driving a truck, a goods truck around Europe because she could not get a job in anything that was related to what she'd studied. And there's like a whole population of people who, you know, they're not violent, but they have been waiting a long time for, you know, people to retire so they can get a job.
Definitely unstable times.
Very unstable.
So linking back then, because you were talking about a knowledge economy and, you know, how the work you do is really based around knowledge rather than, you know, making something new. Again, is it like, how many people does this affect? Because I think it's almost, you know, when we think about the internet and the possibilities it opens up, it does open them up, but it opens them up for a certain very minute proportion of the population that has access to computers and education and electricity and et cetera, et cetera. So although you have like one part of the population operating on that level, you also have another part of the population that's increasingly disenfranchised because they're not necessarily accessing all of these things.
Yeah, well, this came up, you know, not too long ago at the NetHui, which was organised by Internet New Zealand, about sort of is the internet is it a public good that we should be, that governments should be, you know, should we be treating it like a
public
commodity,
utility?
So that's the word I was looking for. And
yeah, it came up at the other conference.
This is interesting, given that we've now just sort of signed up to a. What was probably the result of an international kind of a trade agreement to do the three strikes and you're out. And the three strikes thing on the internet is that we could cut your internet off. And people are like, well, this could be argued to be a human right, access to the internet.
Communication, we communicate on the internet, and I don't know the figures, but let me guess that most of our communication as a society is now done on the internet. So if you cut somebody's internet off, it's like shutting down their road, not letting them out of their house, refusing to let them talk to their neighbours. There's an argument, I'm not sure I'm entirely with it, but there's an argument that this is a public infrastructure like a roading system or a telephone network.
I think that ties into the equity question, you know, that I think that it's that the government's investment in broadband was, I think was the right thing to do. And particularly given that there was a sort of a collateral amount of money invested in broadband infrastructure in rural areas, which were the areas that were most likely to suffer from this kind of infrastructure and probably house the poorest individuals. So I think New Zealand is not doing so bad in this regard. And actually, and in a lot of the countries too, there was someone from India there who was talking about, while, you know, a lot of Indians may not have what we would consider access to the internet as in like a computer in their house, there's a huge penetration of mobile devices and mobile devices these days, which have come with sort of, you know, preset access to internet services, the Facebooks and the, you know, the Twitters and this kind of thing, and can down and, you know, can view web pages. And I think recently we just got to a level where something like 46% of all internet traffic was going through mobile devices. So
having said
possibly
that,
not as disparate as we expect. And I mean, you know, I'm sure if you're like in Somalia, you're probably not rocking around with your iPhone, but
But having said that, the Indians read the newspaper. I mean, they're yep. You know, they're people buy.
But
the
we also
newspaper.
Learned that newspapers are on their way out, didn't we?
Yeah, but not in necessarily no. in places like India.
No, in fact, there was a strong argument made that this whole by another professor, Dwayne Winsick from Canada, this whole argument that media's in trouble, actually, from a political economy perspective, it's doing just fine, thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
And in capitalist terms, the capital is secure, the profits are rolling in. What's suffering is the public service, obviously, the idea of media as a public good. So there's another a wonderful New Zealand academic called Gavin Ellis, who's just completed his PhD on the ownership of the media in global terms, not just local terms. And he was the one predicting that within 5 years, we're going to lose the daily newspaper. Not necessarily the weekend newspaper, but the daily newspaper.
Oh, interesting.
Five years. Some people have said 40, 50. Gavin says 5.
How are we going to light the fire?
More fish and chips. Eat more fish and chips.
Seeing as we don't have the Waiheke weekend or anywhere.
Right,
we're quite lucky in Waiheke because we do have multiple sources of information, and we also have a community radio station, which is a little bit of a bastion of difference that a lot of communities probably don't have. Look, we don't have any commercials. We're not influenced by people, you know, trying to do
and
this.
And it's not just the radio; it's the cinema labor. As well.
And we can talk about things like this, which you probably wouldn't hear on radio live.
I can hear them turning off in the droves.
And as a
that's fine. Yeah.
In terms of making films, there's also the cinema, so you can actually show people films about things that people are concerned
Waiheke
about.
Island
local,
is Waiheke Island just like
quite
a
incredible.
Petri dish of how to do it and how not to do it?
Well, you know, Basil Holmes.
We love ourselves.
Basil Holmes was one of the first people to say
and each
this,
other because we're a community.
This was a microcosm, and this is the danger of the homogenization of everything from local government.
It is happening. He did specifically in his thing. He talked about not being consulted with for works, and I think you know this is happening all the time. You know, all of a sudden you wake up one morning and there's a gutter down. I mean, not that I've got anything huge against gutters, but
I think you need a few more.
Yeah, and you know, mines are in the gutter. Maybe that would be, you know, but it's true. You know, you do just wake up and all of a sudden there's some curbing or this
and
that.
I found myself driving to the wharf the other day, thinking, why am I going so fast down this road?
But again,
to the
it's
wharf?
Like again,
because it's, been, yeah.
because, it's because you can.
And then again, it's those choices. It's like, okay, well, you've got the seaside sanctuary that's struggling maybe to pay its staff, and then you suddenly got, you know, another couple of hundred thousand to stick in a big drain and a big road somewhere, and it's like, well, why don't we have control over how that money is dispensed?
What were they going to spend on the welcome sculpture? Was it something like 5,000?
Oh, it's ridiculous. The fact that they were even thinking about that, was it again 150,000?
I think it's in the budget. It's in the
budget.
I think it made it into the budget, didn't it? Chris questioned them about it and on the radio, on Waiheke Radio.
Waiheke Radio.
And they sort of politically skirted around the thing, as they do. I think
the latest proposal is for a sculpture walk that crosses the island. A sculpture walk that crosses the island, despite the fact we have Alison Park dedicated to sculptures already, despite the fact that civic art is usually the most boring art in the world.
How much time do you spend in Alison Park?
Oh, really?
I mean, unless
I've
you've got a dog.
I've lived on this island 16 years, and I must have crossed Alison Park twice.
And the only reason you did that is probably because at the time you were living on the other side of it.
I think my car was broken down.
Well, you have no legs.
Great. Okay, well, Brent, did you need to
I've got to go pick up the boy from soccer.
Right, okay, excellent. And Greg, would you like to stay a little bit longer?
Oh, only if you can bear it.
Okay, yes. I know, we love it. Okay,
all right,
good.
Well, thank you very much.
Great.
And, Make sure you listen out for my lovely voice on Tuesday nights at 8 o'clock at the B Square Blue Show.
Yes, very popular.
Sponsored by the Waiheke Budgeting Service.
Waiheke Radio.
Great. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to the Interviews from Island Life, our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirua.